I didn't know how many we would have, but it looks like most of us. So that's great. In Luke chapter 23, I believe we got down through, I guess, about verse 12, where he faced Herod. Yep. Okay. So we're going to pick up in verse 13. It says, "Then Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, said to them, 'You have brought this man to me as one who misleads the people. And indeed, having examined him in your presence, I have found no fault in this man concerning those things of which you accuse him. No, neither did Herod, for I sent you back to him. And indeed, nothing deserving of death has been done by him. I will therefore chastise him and release him. For it was necessary for him to release one to them at the feast.' And they cried out at once, saying, 'Away with this man and release to us Barabbas, who had been thrown into prison for a certain rebellion made in the city and for murder.' Pilate, therefore, wishing to release Jesus, again called out to them. But they shouted, saying, 'Crucify him, crucify him.' Then he said to them the third time, 'Why? What evil has he done? I find no reason for death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go.' But they were insistent, demanding with loud voices that he be crucified. And the voices of these men and of the chief priests prevailed. So Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they requested. And he released to them the one they requested, who for rebellion and murder had been thrown into prison. But he delivered Jesus to their will." All right. So we're through with trials now, right? We saw him go to, well, he's been to the high priest, been to Herod, he's been to Pilate, now back to Pilate, right? So just bringing in some other details that we know from the other Gospels, I don't want to get into John too much, but we're months away from the end of John, so I don't mind stomping on it a little bit. We know from John, after he released Barabbas, say around Luke chapter, or Luke 23, around verse 18 in there, you know, 18, 19, release Barabbas. Then it says verse 20 here, Pilate therefore wishing to release Jesus called out to them again, right? And so in John we see that when, you know, after having released Barabbas, he still is trying to get Jesus released. And so that's when you get the crown of thorns and the purple robe, and he brings the people out, or brings them out to the people and says, "Behold the King of the Jews." And they say, "Well, if you don't crucify him, you're not Caesar's friend." And so he heard that. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. So that's kind of the details that kind of fill in verse 20, I guess, when Pilate called out to him one last time, trying to get them to, you know, have him released. Of course, though, they weren't having it. So to him multiple times here, and said to him the first time, "The man's done nothing wrong. You know, I find absolutely no reason to put him to death." Obviously, we know Jesus had done nothing to violate Roman law, which would be something Pilate could have put him to death for. If he had committed blasphemy, then that was something that the Jews could execute him for. But the Jews would have had to do it. They would have had to take him outside the city and stone him. I looked it up. It's in Leviticus, maybe 16. The penalty for blasphemy is definitely immediate death. You get dragged out of the city and stoned to death. Right? So if the Jews wanted to be good Jews, that's what they would have done to Jesus. If they thought he was actually blaspheming, that would be the course of action. However, of course, we know that because of Jesus' popularity and his following, that wasn't going to happen. You know, if they had tried to take Jesus and drag him outside the city and stone him, they would have been stopped by an angry mob, basically. So that's why they ended up here with the Romans, so, and with Pilate. We get a few details here in Luke that we don't get in the other Gospels about Barabbas. John calls Barabbas a thief. We find out in Luke that, I guess, in addition to being a thief, he also was involved in a rebellion and committed murder. So we got this tradition going on where they release somebody to the Jews. I didn't look into it. I'm not a historian. But if I had to guess, this was probably some deal they basically made with the Jewish leaders to keep the peace. You know, it sounds like a political arrangement to me. Like, okay, look, we'll release a prisoner once a year, you know, that kind of thing, right? Kind of what it sounds like to me. I don't know the details. But for whatever reason, they had this tradition. And these leaders of the people said, no, go ahead and release a murderer back amongst us instead. And that's what they were willing to do for in order to get Jesus crucified. I've often wondered, how did the general population feel about this, right? Like, I'm guessing other people might have known who Barabbas was. And so for these chief priests and scribes and everybody to be shouting for his release, kind of wonder how everybody else felt about that. But it didn't matter. He got released. Yeah, I'm with you. But yeah, and certainly, like I said, you, the followers of Christ at this point either did one of two things. Either they joined the mob and started shouting, crucify him, crucify him, or they ducked and covered, which is reasonable, which is what Jesus said to do, even, right? Stay out of it, you know. So one or the other, that's what the disciples are doing at this point. But yeah, I mean, I'm with you, Jason. You'd have to think that some of them now have just kind of followed the crowd and are with everybody else here shouting, crucify him. Let me see if there's anything else I want to bring out in these here. Yeah, all it takes is a voice, a loud voice sometimes to get people going. You know, that's was Hitler's skill. He was a fabulous orator. And so he was able to stir up people and get them on his side. You know, he obviously wasn't a very good military man, but he had that going for him. That's how he ended up getting his following, was he was great at making speeches. Jason says historically he was on meth when he gave those speeches, so I guess you'd be pretty wound up and have a good energetic delivery on that. I don't know. But, all right, so he's delivered. Radis. All right. Anything else on those verses before we move on? Like I said, I know the one thing that's unique to Luke here is that section about Barabbas being in the rebellion and a murderer and stuff. All right, well, continuing on then, verse 26. It says, now as they led him away, they laid hold of a certain man, Simon, a Cyrenian, who was coming from the country, and on him they laid the cross that he might bear it after Jesus. And a great multitude of the people followed him, and women also mourned and lamented him. But Jesus, turning to them, said, daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For indeed the days are coming in which they will say, blessed are the barren, wombs that never bore, and breasts which never nursed. Then they will begin to say to the mountains, fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. For if they do these things in the green wood, what will be done in the dry? There were also two others, criminals, led with him to be put to death. And when they had come to the place called Calvary, there they crucified him, and the criminals, one on the right and the other on the left. Then Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. And they divided his garments and cast lots. And the people stood looking on, but even the rulers with them sneered, saying, He saved others, let him save himself if he is the Christ, the chosen of God. The soldiers also mocked him, coming and offering him sour wine, and saying, if you are the King of the Jews, save yourself. And an inscription was also written over him in letters of Greek, Latin, and Hebrew. This is the King of the Jews. Then one of the criminals who were hanged blasphemed him, saying, If you are the Christ, save yourself and us. But the other, answering, rebuked him, saying, Do you not even fear God, seeing that you are under the same condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we receive the due reward for our deeds. But this man has done nothing wrong. Then he said to Jesus, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus said to him, Assuredly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. That was a long reading. We'll break it down into some sections here. So first off, in verse 26, we get this account of them compelling some other dude to carry his cross. Wouldn't it have been great to be this guy, right? And just be standing around, probably, I don't know what he was there for, but they said, hey, you carry that. We know Roman soldiers had the authority to compel people to do stuff, right? And I think this is an example of that here. Simon ends up carrying the cross. I think Matthew talks about how Jesus became unable to carry it, basically where he got to the point where he wasn't able to carry it, and so they grabbed Simon. We get that there is still this crowd. You know, Jason mentioned the crowd being around. This describes it here as a multitude. So there, remember, there's literally hundreds of thousands of people in Jerusalem for this. And so there's a crowd, a substantial crowd going on here. And the women who also mourned and lamented him. So we know who some of these women were, right? We know at least that we have Jesus' mother, Mary, and we have Mary Magdalene there, right? They're following along. And then Jesus has this teaching moment, basically, with them. And this is one of those things that's hard for me to imagine. He's been through torture at this point, right? To the point where he couldn't carry his cross, which the cross was a big thing, so still. And they're crying and weeping for him. And he turns around, bloody and beaten and bruised and crowned with thorns and skin hanging off his bones, and says, Don't weep for me, weep for yourselves and your kids. There's going to come a time that it's worse. He says, for if they do these things in the green wood, what will be done in the dry? I interpret that as if they do these things while I'm here, what are they going to do when I'm not? There's going to come a time where y'all are going to wish for better days, right? Remember, he told the apostles that too, where there's going to come a time where you're going to wish for these days when I was here. He stops and talks to the crowd while he's being drugged along, bloody and beaten, and who knows what kind of condition he's in, and stops to teach. So then it talks about the others that were crucified with him, the two criminals, and the discussion that they had. This is one thing that always kind of blows my mind, is when people, you know, you'll see a cross in people's yards and stuff. For one thing, it kind of blows my mind just to have that. Because it's kind of like, let me have an electric chair. Right? Because that's an execution device. Okay? That was a method of murdering people and torturing them to death, basically. So that's going to be your symbol of your faith? It's kind of weird to me, right? Like, I'm more with the little fishy thing. You know, I understand that a little bit more reasonably, right? Obviously, none of these symbols are approved. We're not supposed to worship symbols, right? But what really gets me is when you have all three crosses. And I'm like, okay, so now we're remembering the thieves too? Like, we're memorializing them as well? Like, that really gets me when I see all those. And then, of course, Christ's cross is bigger because he was more important than the other ones. Not like they were all the same size or anything. But it's funny to me that people memorialize the cross. You know, and certainly Jesus dying on the cross was necessary. It didn't matter how he died. He just had to die. And so people put torture devices staked up in their yard in the springtime to remember Jesus. It's kind of funny to me, but that's just me. It's continuing on with the thieves. So they get them up on the crosses, basically. And we have the statement by Jesus, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. Doing that they didn't know what they were doing. That was What were they doing? Easy question, right? That they didn't understand that they were doing. Killing the Son of God. They knew they were killing somebody from God. Okay? Remember Nicodemus, teacher, we know you are from God. Right? They couldn't argue with the miracles. Remember, they wanted to kill Lazarus because they couldn't argue with him being raised from the dead. Right? They knew they were killing a prophet. Straight up knew that for sure. What they didn't know is they were killing the Son of God. Did forgiving for either of it, right? For any of it. No, that's a good point, Jason. For the sake of folks at home, he said, you know, maybe who's the audience for Jesus' statement here, or who's he talking about as far as Father forgive them? Is them the Romans who are in the situation where they're crucifying him and they don't even know why? Like Pilate basically said, I don't know why you want to kill this guy, right? So maybe that's who Jesus is talking about. Maybe he's talking about the Jews because they don't know they're killing the Son of God. But they were, like I said, very aware if they were killing at least a prophet of God. Maybe it was all of them. We don't know. But at any rate, we know that while Jesus was hanging on the cross, he was worried about somebody's sins. Right? Now, obviously, on the cross, he was taking care of everybody's sins. Right? But even hanging there, you know, we have the phrase often or several times that Jesus had compassion on him or her or them or whoever. I almost kind of think about that. That he's looking at these people that are doing this awful thing, has compassion on them, and is worried about their souls while he's actively dying to save their souls. He's praying for their forgiveness. Get the thieves. Well, first we get some taunting, right? All these others, you know. So now, like I said, with these chief priests and scribes and Pharisees, they know what Jesus has done. Right? They know about his miracles. So now they think they've got him, though. You saved others, save yourself. They're mocking him, saying, oh, you had all this power. We got power over you now. That's what they're trying to say. Is we won. We know they weren't winning. Obviously, we know Jesus didn't have to be on that cross if he didn't want to. Wanted to be on that cross because it's what had to happen to save people's souls. Mocking him for not coming down when he obviously very well could have. So then we have the inscription that Pilate put on there, and we have other details from the other Gospels, I think Gary and Matthew, about the fact that the Jews were not happy about this at all. But he put a sign up over Jesus that said the King of the Jews. Why? We don't know why Pilate put that up there. I kind of want to think that he's highlighting it to him. That, hey, look, this is the only thing this guy said that you're mad about is King of the Jews. Right? So he put Jesus' charge, what they charged him with, above. And that's just, like I said, I don't know why Pilate did it. I kind of want to say that that's so that the scribes and the Pharisees and all of them had to stare at it. But I don't know exactly, so. Then we get on, but we did make, it is worth noting that he put it in basically all three languages that anybody around there would have known one of those languages, all right? Even if you were from somewhere distant, there's a real, real, real good chance, almost impossible, that you didn't at some point learn Greek, Latin, or Hebrew, right? We had the Greek Empire, now we're in the early ages of the Roman Empire. So he wrote it in Greek, Latin, and then, of course, the Hebrew that they were speaking there, or that the Jews spoke anyway. So in verse 9 again, if you are Christ, save yourself and us. I mean, and the other guy calls him out on it, but it's like, okay, you're hanging on the cross, and now you're going to mock the other guy hanging next to you. Don't you even fear God? This guy shows a whole heap of faith in these statements, all right? Do not Do you not even fear God, seeing under you're the same under you are under the same condemnation? Deserve it. He's done nothing wrong. All right, so he knows who Jesus is, right? This guy hanging next to him knows who Jesus is enough to know that he's done nothing to deserve being on that cross next to him. Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. I'm going to say that this man understood more than the apostles to some degree. Because he's talking to Jesus as Jesus is dying. And says, remember me in your kingdom. Others, disciples misunderstood the nature of Christ's kingdom, thought he was going to be a king on earth, right? And that was a lot of the confusion with the disciples and the apostles and everything is, hey, when are you going to be king now? When is this going to happen, right? Well, this crook on the cross did something to the point where he could tell a dying Christ, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Hey, and that's some knowledge, you know. That means he had to hear some teaching at some point, right, to know that Christ was going to have a kingdom, right? But it stood out to me that he says this about Christ coming into his kingdom as he is dying.
Which says that he knew his name, not just that he was the Christ.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We have to remember that Christ is his last name, right? It's his title.
Yes.
Christ. So some people are calling him the Christ, right? Calling him the Messiah, you're the Messiah, and you come to save everybody to save yourself. Remember me when I'm here. Yeah, he knew. He knew.
Jesus responds, assuredly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise. So then we, just to rehash the same old thief got saved on the cross thing, right? Well, Jesus said the thief was going to be saved. He never got baptized. What's the deal? Anybody? There we go. Ding, ding, ding. That's my answer. I'm talking about the Son of God. He can forgive sins. He did it with the adulterous woman, right? Forgave her sins. He has power to forgive sins. He's God. That's who holds sins against you, right? Is God. He has power to forgive sins. We have the advantage of having Jesus standing next to us, you know, and being merciful enough to pardon our sins, right? He had to die to make that happen. So, but while he was on earth with people, he could forgive their sins. And that's what he did for this thief on the cross. Anything else on the robber, on the thief, before we move on. Yeah, right? Yeah. Jesus shows up and says, you're forgiven. I'm down. But until that happens, we got to follow the plan, you know, involve baptism and learning and good works and all kind of stuff, right? So, all right. Fair enough, then that'll wrap up that section. We'll continue on verse 44, unless anybody has anything else to add. All right. About the sixth hour, and there was darkness over all the earth until the ninth hour. Somebody want to tell us the time frame here? Right. Third hour is roughly 9 a.m. Day starts at dawn. So if you're going to round it off the times, six starts the day, third hour is 9, 6 hours noon, right? Give or take. They cut time by the sun, not a time X, right? So it's dark from noon to 3 p.m. roughly. I would imagine that got people's attention, right?
All over the world.
What's that?
All over the world.
Yeah, it says all the earth. Some people in China were probably wondering what on earth was going on, right? Then the sun was darkened and the veil of the temple was torn in two. So this is my question. If it was darkness over all the earth and then the sun was darkened, where did darkness come from? Well, we know God caused darkness on the Egyptians just for them and not for the Israelites, right? But maybe it was just the sun was darkened that caused all the darkness. Maybe it's just all the same statement. But so it looks like Oh, well, we can explain this away. That's a solar eclipse. I can explain that away, no problem, right? The problem with that is they have calendars about those things, and we can actually go back and backdate when the eclipses happened, right? And so if we really wanted to go there, we could. But we don't even have to go there because we know what happened. God blotted out the sun. Need to know, right? 46. And when Jesus had cried out with a loud voice, he said, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." Having said this, he breathed his last. So when the centurion saw what had happened, he glorified God, saying, "Certainly this was a righteous man." And the whole crowd who came together to that sight, seeing what had been done, beat their breasts and returned. But all his acquaintances and the women who followed him from Galilee stood at a distance watching these things. Darkness, and we had the veil of the temple being torn. The veil of the temple, well, what was this veil? Let's just start beginning to make sure everybody's on the same page. What veil are we talking about?
Holy of Holies.
It separated the holy place from the Holy of Holies, right? One person once a year goes through that veil, right? With a rope tied around his waist just in case things go bad. Right? Y'all remember that? Like, seriously, you're going to go in the presence of God. We're going to tie a rope around your waist in case you don't make it out of there alive. All right? We know, we're told that humans can't handle the presence of God. Right? This veil separates man from God. That is the purpose of that veil. Is to separate the most holy place, the Ark of the Covenant, the seat of God, and to separate that from the rest of the world. That's the point of this veil. Jesus is on the cross, and that's a rip.
A veil sounds painful, right? When we go to a veil, we think of a pride veil. It was not.
Now, we're talking a four-story building.
Massive,
yeah. Yeah.
It wasn't a veil.
No. Yeah, you mentioned it being a tapestry. This would have been a very, very ornate, very lavish thing too. It's in the temple. You got to remember, the temple is like the most rich building on earth, right? As far as the gold and the jewels and all the embellishment and all that. Herod the Great was serious when he expanded that temple. All right, he wanted it to be the fanciest place on earth, and it was. God provided for it, right? So the veil tears. I've often wondered, now obviously we've got this big thing going on out on Calvary, right? I wonder if anybody was in the temple. Like, what if you were in the temple standing there, and all of a sudden that thing tore on its own? I mean, they had seen plenty of miracles and stuff that Jesus did, but something like that, like you said, this massive tapestry that nobody has ever seen even move, all of a sudden goes, right? And it said top to bottom, right? Top to bottom. So it's not even like somebody cut it at the bottom, grabbed it, and pulled. Sucker's head. Obviously not figuratively, but yes, sir. Turn just read for us an account from a secular historian of these events that happened during the crucifixion. Like we said, these things weren't, this wasn't very localized. This wasn't just happening on the hill of Calvary, right? This wasn't just happening in Jerusalem. Ooh. The veil of the temple is torn. What does that symbolize? There you go. God is now available to everyone. Right? Jews are the only one special anymore. High priest. It's not just the high priest that can have God's, that can have an audience with God. Right? What's can now? The veil tears. And then verse 46, and when Jesus had cried out with a loud voice, he says, "Father, into your hands I commit my spirit." And having said this, he breathed his last. Father, into your hands I commit my spirit is a quote from a psalm. So again, here on the cross, the last thing Jesus says is fulfillment of prophecy. The centurion says, certainly this was a righteous man. We know from another account, he said, surely this was the Son of God. Standing around these Romans that kind of got drugged into this situation, I think started figuring out that maybe they should have stayed out of it. I mean, I can't imagine Pilate. Think about everything Pilate's been through. He tried to release this man over and over and over and over. His wife came to him and said, I was given a vision about that guy. You need to get him out of here. You need to let him go. Have nothing to do with that, right? Basically politically pressured into succumbing to what they want and crucifying Jesus. And so then he's sitting back, letting this thing happen. And the whole earth goes dark and earthquakes. We know from Matthew, people rising from the dead. What is Pilate thinking at that point? He said, yeah, let it be on us and our children.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He didn't want to take it to you. And Romans had no qualms about crucifying you.
No.
Right? It's not that crucifixion came with a bad thing. This man had nothing. His blood.
Yeah. Yeah, they obviously were already planning the crucifixion this day. They had two robbers they had to take care of, right? So the Romans were already in the middle of executing people. They just...
They were ready to crucify Barabbas.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I've always wondered, what's Pilate thinking? Sitting wherever he's sitting in his little judgment seat or in his house, wherever he's at, and all this starts going on. And he says, man, I tried. You know, I hope Pilate found some faith. I kind of doubt it, but I hope so. Like we said, we see the centurion recognizing Christ's deity. It says, then the whole crowd who came together to that site, seeing what had been done, beat their breasts and returned. What does that mean, beat their breasts and return? Action, what does that mean? Mourning. Yes. We get that description a lot. With, especially in the Old Testament, with people, you know, the sackcloth and ashes and beating their breasts, right? This mourning. So, the whole crowd who came together to that site, seeing what had been done, beat their breasts and returned. I think some people had their minds changed. I think some of these events going on with the crucifixion clued people into what had actually just happened. At least to the point where they were no longer celebrating it. They were mourning, right? And we know.
The average guy,
there's no struggle, there's no fight, there's no fuss. Yeah, you mentioned those nails. That's one thing I've thought about doing before, because I don't think I really understand what that means. Get you a garden spike. That's about what we're talking about. Get you a sledgehammer and pound it into that deck right there. That's the force that they drove into Jesus' hand. All right. Just so you know, that band, Nine Inch Nails, is referring to the nails that went into Christ's hands. So maybe don't listen to them. Don't buy their stuff a whole lot. But bad, because I like some of their old music. But anyways, but yeah, it would be physically devastating. And certainly, Christ handled it differently. So, to Matthew, no wonder it's being looked weird. I flipped over to Matthew because in Matthew 27, verse 54, we have, so when the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and the things that had happened, they feared greatly, saying, truly, this was the Son of God. So seeing all the power that God was manifesting on earth right then, not just the centurion, but says the others with him guarding Jesus, like the other ones actively crucifying him, recognized deity in that man on the cross. So, all right, thank y'all. We'll pick up wherever we left off. There in the middle of chapter 23 on Sunday. Thank y'all.